Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today we're going to talk about interest rates. And you might think, oh my gosh, I'm going to listen to true crime right now. Actually, I promise this is going to be a lot more interesting than you would think, because interest rates really kind of rule everything from a financial perspective. And as someone who has a lot of student loan debt, you unfortunately are probably a lot more familiar with the negatives of interest rates than, you know, your average person, right? Because you've been through the stress and the anxiety of watching your loan build up at more than you borrowed in a lot of cases. I mean, this is pretty much always the case for someone who's a student, because you take the loan out and then you're in school and the interest kind of builds up on you while you're in school, because they did away with subsidized loans for graduate school. So the interest just builds up while you're enrolled, and then you owe, you know, significantly more than what you borrowed, and it can be really stressful. So today I want to talk about what interest rates are, what's going on in the economy right now with interest rates, and how, you know, they've sort of been on a rising trend since we hit the lowest part of the interest rates during the worst of the pandemic. And then I want to talk about what it means for your life and how you can kind of make some big decisions based off of what might be happening with interest rates in terms of making decisions that are going to positively impact your financial future. First, let's talk about what interest rates are. What is an interest rate? The interesting thing is, if you think about what is an interest rate, it's not the same thing as saying, you know, what is gravity? Right? Gravity is a sort of natural scientific law. It's a thing that, you know, humans didn't invent, right? I mean, humans invented the word gravity, but not the actual concept and the way it works, right? Whereas interest rates is something that basically humans made up. It's a system that we use to allocate capital, and it's a system that we use to measure risk, and it makes the economy run. So here's an example. If I needed to buy a house, but I don't have the money, what do? You take out a mortgage, right? Now imagine if I couldn't do that. Imagine if I was not able to take out a loan to buy a house. Well, then that would block me from buying a house until I had enough cash money saved up to purchase one. And wow, if you think about it, that could take me a really long time. And then I wouldn't be able to put to work the builders that would build it, the people that might maintain the lawn if I didn't want to mow my own grass. It would reduce property taxes to fund local governments. It'd be really negative economically, right? So it's pretty obvious right away when you start thinking of some real world examples why, you know, loans in a lot of cases are a good thing, because they enable you to purchase things that you could never afford unless you had to save up for it. But then if you had to save up for it, it would make the economy worse off. So consider like a degree, for example, dental school. You might not have $500,000 to pay for dental school. If you wait 20 years until you've saved up 500 grand, then you could be a dentist. Great, a 45 to 50 year old dentist who is only 15 years away from back problems, right? I mean, that's why you have loans, because you're able to borrow the money up front, go to school, and get this higher income. Now, as bad as dental school debt is, pretty much in every situation besides the absolute worst private school cost scenarios, you could afford to pay it back if you really had to. You wouldn't like it. It would really suck. It'd be really miserable, but you could. And so if you think about debt, you know, you take out this debt, it enables you to buy something, and the economy is way better off from you being a dentist in your 20s than being a dentist in your 40s. While you are working odd jobs to save up the money for go to dental school. So you borrow. And it's pretty clear, of course, that one impact of loans sometimes is to raise prices. So for example, since people can pay based on their income, dental school costs a lot more, or your professional degree, whatever it is, costs way more than it would if you had to pay cash, simply because the loan system finances it. And so that makes consumers more able to pay a higher price. The price is more. Same thing with mortgages. If you have a subsidized mortgages, if you have government involvement in the mortgage space, home properties tend to be higher than they would be otherwise. On the flip side, more people have access, which is a really good thing. If you didn't have any regulation at all in the student loan market or the mortgage market, then fewer people could get access to growing their wealth that way. And that would be a negative, a big negative, actually. And, you know, if you think about who would that most negatively impact, it would be underrepresented students. It would be first-generation students. That would be a very difficult thing. That would be a very bad thing. So if you think about what is the cost of debt you borrow, how much should you pay for that money? And if you say nothing, then the problem with that answer is that if you never charged interest at all, period, then the person that would be lending that money would lose money and they would go out of business and they wouldn't be able to lend any future capital to anyone else to do things that they wanted to do. And then that next person trying to buy the house would not be able to build the house that they want to build or purchase or whatever, right? So you do have to charge interest to some degree. Now, there are some very ancient secular and religious traditions against interest, right? There's neither a borrower nor a lender be. And then there's also, you know, I'm not a religious scholar, I'm not a religious expert, but I know that, you know, for some observant Muslims, for example, you are not supposed to, I think, invest in things that charge interest. It's forbidden under religious tenets. So it's kind of interesting. But again, this interest stuff is something that humans made up to like run the world economy, and it's been around for a long time. Now, you have to charge a cost, generally speaking, for a loan, for making a loan. And who sets the cost? Well, it's the government and mostly the market, though. Probably the market is a lot more relevant than the government involvement, although the government involvement is becoming more and more important as to what interest rates are. So let's talk about how interest rates get set in the economy. There's two kinds of things you want to know. There's something called term premium and there's credit premium. So term premium is essentially like a fancy word for like how long are you locking your money up for? So think about this. You're going to give me a loan for $10,000 for 5 years and you're going to give me a $10,000 loan for 30 years. Would you want more interest for the loan for 5 or 30? You'd obviously want it more for the 30-year loan, right? That would be locking up money for far more time. And so you would want a higher interest rate for locking up the money for 30 years compared to 5. So that's one reason why when you're looking at a 30-year mortgage or a 20-year student loan refinance versus a shorter one, that's why they charge more interest, because in general, you have to get paid more as a lender to give a loan for a longer period of time. And why does it have to be higher for a longer term, you know, loan? Well, think about it also this way. Like, what's the big risk to somebody that's lending money? It's that there would be lots of inflation and the value of your money would go poof, right? So the government, over a longer period of time, there's a greater risk. The government could print a lot of money and then you would get way less than the value of your actual loan that you lent out because of inflation. So that's kind of like, in general, an understanding of why like a 30-year mortgage costs more than a 15-year mortgage. What about credit risk? Why do student loans cost more than mortgages? So credit risk is the risk that you don't get paid back. And sometimes you can mitigate the risk of not getting paid back by having the loan secured by something. Okay, so think about this. The credit risk of the U.S. government is zero. That's the world assumption for the world financial system, is that the lowest risk borrower of all is the U.S. government. There is a 0% chance that the U.S. government will not pay you back. And that's simply true because if the government had to, they could just print money and pay you back with printed money. And obviously that could devalue the loan that you have outstanding with the government. But in general, the risk of them physically paying you back is literally zero. Now, everyone else has a risk that is greater than zero. So let's compare lending for a house to lending to a degree. And let's think like the average degree, not like a medical degree or a law degree or a dental degree where the value of it could be, you know, way more, right? And you might say, well, you know, maybe they shouldn't be charging that much mathematically for a degree like that. So let's say you know the degree's paying off and the house is a reasonable house to buy. So here's the thing. If you don't pay off your house, what happens? In normal times, you know, not pandemic notwithstanding, the bank seizes your house. The bank takes your house and they sell it in a foreclosure. Right. And so that means that, let's say your typical person, first of all, the very first payment you're probably going to make is on your house if you can. You're probably a lot more likely to pay your house payment than you are your student loan payment, just in general. Because think about it, just like, what's more important to you, shelter or like making the person that paid for your degree whole? It's pretty obvious, right? And then the other thing is the bank can seize the property and sell it. So they know that the consequences of you not paying them are less than something like an unsecured loan, like a credit card rate. So if you think about how much extra interest the lender wants to get paid on top of the regular risk that you would call the term risk for how long you're locking your money up for, the other big risk is how likely are they to get paid back. You know, if you think values are stable for housing are going up, by the way, you could lend it to everybody and think you're going to make your money back just by the person selling the home if they can't pay you back. That's kind of one reason we got in big trouble with the housing crisis in 2007, is because everybody assumed values for homes would go up forever. So for securitized lending, there is security in case you don't pay the loan back for the lender. So security would be, for example, a mortgage or a practice loan or a car loan. They literally have something that they can seize if you don't pay them back. And so therefore, there's lower risk to the borrower. And so the lender charges a lower interest rate to the person that's taking out the loan because there's less risk for the lender. So let's talk about unsecuritized lending, of which student loans are kind of a kind of that. So unsecuritized lending is when you cannot really seize something to get paid back if somebody doesn't pay you back. So consider like double-digit percentages of people in the student loan world were not paying their student loans, were in default on their student loans, right? Right away, you're kind of thinking like, wow, if the government was not involved in the student loan market at all, if you just have like, I think it was like a 12% default rate, something like that, assume that a lot of those people end up paying you back. Maybe say half of those people do end up paying the loan back at some point, at least to some level. So right away, you're sort of assuming 5% losses on the portfolio. To break even, you'd probably have to say, you know, 5% plus whatever the interest rates are in the economy of maybe 1.5% or 2%. You know, right from there, you're kind of like at a 6-7% interest rate just based off of the risk of loss for everybody overall. So what about for the individual person? Like, how do you, you know, determine what rate to charge someone on an unsecuritized loan? And a securitized loan too, but a loan that just you're making a credit card loan or a personal loan or something like that. How do they determine that? Well, that's why we have credit scores. The credit score thing is very imperfect, but there you have to have a system. We have a system and that's what it is. It's not a perfect one, right? So you can get up to an 850 credit score. And then a lot of people that have bad credit, you might have 400, 500 something, I think, credit score. I think maybe 500 is some of the lower scores. Kind of 600 is like, okay. And 700 something or above is really pretty good. And so credit score, they have all these formulas that go into it, right? But you know that somebody with a good credit score is probably somebody that's more likely to pay you back. And somebody with a low credit score is probably somebody that's less likely to pay you back. And so that's why someone with a bad score might get charged 10% on a car loan. And somebody that has a really good credit score might get charged maybe 3% on a car loan. It's completely based off of the probability of loss. And obviously that can be discriminatory. You know, if you talk about, you know, redlining or targeting disproportionately African-American communities with different things in the formula that are not fair, that can end up resulting in discrimination too. So that's why the government's really involved in the finance space to try to mitigate some of those inequalities, right? So anyways, in general though, someone with a bad score gets charged more than someone with a good score because of the risk of loss. And that's what this credit risk thing is. It's like how much extra interest do you have to pay in order for the person making the loan to feel okay about the profit and loss risk reward profile to make a loan to someone? So how do these all these interest rates get set? So we showed you that like a practice or a car or a mortgage, that's always going to have a lower risk than lending for a student loan because you can seize one of those things. Thank goodness you cannot seize someone's brain. There's no longer something like indentured servitude where if somebody doesn't pay you back, you can throw them in a debtor's prison, right? That's a good thing. We can't seize someone's brain. And so that's why student loan interest rates will always have to be higher than some of these other kinds of rates, like what you take out for a mortgage, just based on the market, at least. Like, you know, you could obviously say, well, the government could come in and subsidize it because we want to have more people going to school. And that's a different argument. But, you know, if you're just looking at a market-based risk approach, I just want people to understand, even if they don't agree with it, why student loan interest rates are more than other kinds of loans. Now, there's obviously a lot of kinds of loans that are a lot higher interest rates than student loans. So for example, credit card interest rates, why do credit cards charge like 15 to 25% interest in a lot of cases? Well, it's because that when somebody doesn't pay their credit card, you settle this for like pennies on the dollar. Literally, like if you do a bankruptcy, it's so easy to get rid of credit card debt. You know, and somebody might purchase it up for literally pennies on the dollar, so 3 cents, 5 cents, something like that. I mean, the default recovery for credit card debt is really low, and that's why the interest rates are pretty high. And here's the crazy thing. I did this book that no one read like several years ago about mastering your money in your 20s and 30s. It's kind of like before I started Student Loan Planner. And so I got to do a lot of different studies, or I researched a whole lot of things about different consumer finance products. And a lot of times we're kind of in our own little world when it comes to credit and like what we qualify for and what a fair price of credit is and how good an interest rate is or how bad an interest rate is. Oh my gosh, y'all, if you are a lower middle class or upper middle class individual, the finance system that you get to be a part of is worlds better than what the poor get dragged through. It's really quite crazy. You could almost call it criminal, the difference in the interest rates, but it's kind of weird. It's like a market-based system, and market-based systems aren't always the best systems, right? The market-based system, what it does do a good job of is pricing risk, you know, or at least perceived risk. And so I'll explain what I mean by that. So who are the big lenders to the working poor? It's generally not credit card companies. They don't offer credit cards to people below a certain credit score. What happens is like, why do you see things like payday lenders and pawn shops in poor neighborhoods? Well, pawn shops are kind of like the securitized lender of the poor. Somebody might need money. Let's say you need money for a car repair, or you're going to get evicted, or you have, you know, some sort of really important bill. Maybe your electric is getting shut off or something, or maybe your internet's getting shut off. And so you need money quick. And a pawn shop is maybe going to charge you 100 to 200% interest for holding on to your wedding ring or your one of your, you know, weapons or your old computer or something, something of value. And they're going to charge you maybe, like I said, an interest rate, maybe 100%, something like that. And if you don't pay them back, then they have something that they can use and then sell if you don't end up paying them back. So that's like, in general, the idea of a pawn shop. It's like secure lending, right? Except it's secure lending to an insecure population historically. You know, one interesting thing with this pandemic is the typical American families actually received far more in aid income-wise than they've lost in wages during the pandemic. Obviously, if you've been unemployed, that's not the case necessarily. On average, like the typical unemployed person has received more in unemployment payments than the average incomes they were making. So I think that hopefully we'll see a little less of payday lenders and pawn shops for the next couple of years. But you know, eventually they'll be back because it always does come back, unfortunately. So payday lenders, what are the interest rates that they set? So a payday lender has interest rates often north of 400%. That is nuts. That is highway robbery, right? Except why do they charge that? Well, so consider this. If you don't have any assets to secure the loan, you're literally asking for the person's promise to pay you back with someone who has a very low capacity to pay that might have a very low credit score. So the risk of default might be 50% or more. And these are loans that are often for, you know, a couple weeks at a time or something like that. And so the annualized rate often works out to being, you know, 400%. Maybe the actual fee they're charging is sort of, you know, a 30, 40% fee over, you know, a couple weeks or a month or something like that. And so if you're modeling in, you know, a default rate that's very high, plus a profit margin, plus needing to make revenue to keep the lights on and pay the rent and pay the lease on the building and pay people to work there, that's kind of why the market rate for lending to the poor with payday loans is so bad. It's just really interesting to think about 3% for mortgages, 6% for student loans, 15 to 25% for credit cards, and then 100 to 400% for the working poor. I mean, it's kind of the reverse, right? If you think about the pain that somebody that's making $20,000 a year goes through borrowing at that interest rate compared to getting the perfect mortgage interest rate down to the best 0.25%, it puts things in perspective at least a little bit, I think. So that's kind of in general how interest rates work. The risk of a very risky loan, right? That's kind of the extreme end of the spectrum in terms of how they set the interest rate on payday loans versus how they set the interest rate on mortgages, right? So I'm watching The Sopranos right now, actually. It's like this show on about the mob on HBO. And one of the things the mob did back in the day is loan sharking. So they would lend money to people on an unsecured basis. And then if they didn't pay, they could break somebody's kneecap or beat them up or, you know, potentially threaten their family, right? So the weird thing about these payday lenders is you could say they're unethical, and maybe they are, but at the same time, it's kind of interesting to think of, well, is there a demand for this? And if this didn't exist, would the illegal method of getting an unsecured loan, would that be worse? Would that cause more societal harm? It's hard to say, but that's in general the story of interest rates and the economy. So let's talk about why student loan rates are so high. Just even though there's a lot of kinds of loans out there that have way higher interest rates, you know, why are they so high? We've talked about, a lot of people have talked about making student loan interest 0%, and that would be great for our community, right? Our community of high income, high debt borrowers. The downside of that is potentially you might have to pay more in income taxes to cover that. Maybe they would only charge income taxes for people in an income bracket higher than you, but maybe they wouldn't too, right? It just depends. So if you think about charging 0% interest on student loans, at a minimum, the government would lose the interest rate that they're having to borrow at to subsidize the federal student loan program at zero, right? So at a minimum, the government would have to lose money to subsidize student loans. And that's just on the interest rate part of the equation of what they set the rate at, right? Then we know that there would also be credit risk of certain people would not be able to pay the government back. And so then you'd have to charge something higher than the government rate for that loan. Now, student loan rates actually used to be really low. Like sometimes I see people with loans in the early mid 2000s that somehow have like a 2.8% when the rates in the economy were more than that. I'm not really clear why it was that way, But the government did change that, I think, in the late 2000s to sort of a fixed interest rate of 6-something, 7-something. It was kind of not market-based. And then what ended up happening is in the early 2010s, a collection of bipartisan senators passed the Bipartisan Student Loan Certainty Act, I think is what it's called. And it sets a formula for determining what people's student loan interest rates are. They have not yet created a mechanism for refinancing those rates to lower rates for whatever reason. So the rates are fixed and they're set based off of whatever the government borrows at every spring. That's the time that they look at what the government borrows at, and then they say, okay, student loan borrowers are going to pay X percent above what the government borrows at. And so sometimes that works out. So for example, the government was borrowing around 1% last spring, and so the student loan interest rates were at 4.6 for Stafford loans, and I think 5.6 for Grad Plus. And those were some of the lowest rates in a long time. Rates are going to go up. Rates are going to be higher for this next round of borrowing just because the 10-year treasury yield is how they set this rate. And so we're probably going to see that rate go up. My guess is anywhere from 0.5% to 1% higher than interest rates for students borrowing during this 2020 to 2021 school year. I think 2021 to 2022 is probably going to be 5-something for Stafford, 6-something for Grad Plus, probably. So even those numbers might seem high though, right? We talked about the mortgage for 3%. Why is the student loan at 5 or 6? So remember the student loan system in general. Remember that when you call Fed Loan Servicing, you know, they're set up to help the $10,000 borrower. They're not set up to help you. So the federal government knows that overall, private student loan interest rates are often in like the 8 to 12% interest rate range. They're really high. Why is that the case? Well, remember I said credit cards are like 15 to 25%? And they're completely unsecured. You can discharge them easily in bankruptcy. So private student loans are, in general, I think, made to less risky folks on average than credit cards, and they have better protections for the lender that where they're not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Now, you can make some good arguments that private student loan rates might not change that much without bankruptcy protection. We don't really know what would happen until it actually happened. But that's the range of interest rates overall that private companies charge people for student loans. So actually, something in the 4, 5, 6, 7% interest rate range is already actually a big subsidy for your average borrower for what you borrow and pay on student loan debt. It's not low enough, a lot of people would say, but it is already representing a fairly large subsidy. So that's one reason why interest rates are already so high, is because they would be even higher if there wasn't any subsidy at all. So why are rates lower for people who refinance? Well, if you think about it, the government relies on people borrowing more money that do end up paying it back to subsidize the people that are getting very low rates that are way lower than what they would get in the private market. So I think the idea was that these people borrowing more that are higher income would help subsidize the people that are lower income, similarly to how people that earn a lot of money pay a lot more to finance the roads than people who don't earn a lot of money. Think about like an entitlement program like Medicare. That's something everyone uses versus, you know, student loans is something that, you know, only higher income people on average use, higher income compared to the average person, right? And so the government, I think, has taken more of the attitude of, well, we'd like this student loan program to kind of be somewhat cost neutral and sort of break even. And then they realized, well, there's going to be some losses. And then there's a recent report from the Congressional Budget Office that, oh, wait a second, they're going to lose a ton of money on the student loan system. And so will Congress eventually make the student loan system look more like Medicare and Social Security, where it's more of an entitlement program where the government has to subsidize it with hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, with student loan forgiveness, cancellation, lower interest rates, lower income-based repayments? That's probably the direction that I see this program going long term. There might be some reforms. They might limit the amount you can borrow. They might make this program only for people with lower incomes or underrepresented students. I'm not sure, right? But I think that they have been pretending that this is a program that is paying for itself and they're making a profit on student loans, when in fact, if you look at the amount of loan forgiveness that's expected to happen, as you know, our clients know better than anybody, it is way more than what they are projecting and what they're realizing that it will be, just because the loan forgiveness rules are so, so attractive to so many people, particularly with signals like Section 9675 in the American Recovery Plan that are making student loan forgiveness tax-free at all levels for the next 5 years. That probably gets extended. And then over the several decades, you will start seeing, oh my gosh, student loans are so much more expensive than we ever dreamed that they were. If you think about, are interest rates fair? Well, in a good economy, then the rates for the government are probably going to be higher than what you could get through private lenders, either upfront or if you refinance. In a bad economy, the government's probably going to offer lower interest rates than private lenders. And why is that? Remember about credit premium that I talked about in the earlier in the podcast. So credit premium is how much extra yield that a lender's got to get paid to feel comfortable lending money. So in a bad economy, a bad financial crisis, so for example, in March and April of 2020, this thing called credit spreads, which is the same thing as like credit premium, it went sky high. So in other words, it used to be you just had to maybe get an extra 1% to lend to a risky borrower. Well, when COVID shutdowns happened and everybody was freaking out and didn't know what the world economy was going to do, suddenly maybe you'd have to borrow, you had to get an extra 5% to lend to somebody. I mean, that's kind of the idea of what happened. And so there was this big fear. And so now suddenly the government's like the main lender because they have this formula that sets it at a static amount above whatever they're borrowing at for what they charge for student loans. And so that's what happens is sometimes that rate they're charging is too high and sometimes it's too low. During the shutdown period, even private lenders were having to give a lot of people forbearance and not getting paid back. So that's kind of like not getting payback on your student loan principal and interest, right? Let's talk about the chances that the government would totally redo interest rates on student loans. What is the chance that they would reset the interest rates to 3% or zero, or you know, make it zero long term? I mean, it's possible. It's possible, but I would say it's unlikely. And why is that? Low-income borrowers don't really benefit that much from lower interest rates. So think about somebody that's got $10,000 of student debt, that's a single mom, that's working some retail job or some job in hospitality or something, making like a little bit above minimum wage, right? The interest rate that she's being charged is probably 4 or 5% because it's probably a Stafford loan. And that interest rate sets worth about $400 or $500 a year. The payments that she has to make on that $10,000 loan, if she's doesn't know about income-based repayment, things like that, she's got to pay $100 a month on that loan to pay it off in 10 years. So $100 a month or getting a lower interest rate on your loan, I mean, which one's more impactful? Well, you know, the lower payment would benefit her more than the lower interest rate probably. More generous income-based repayment or cancellation especially would benefit her a lot more than some sort of interest rate reform. Who would benefit from lower interest rates on federal student loans the most? Our audience would, right? High income, high debt borrowers that are planning, a lot of them which planning to pay them back eventually. Because obviously the interest rate's sort of irrelevant if you're pursuing forgiveness, right? I've told people this a lot. Like it doesn't matter if the interest rate's 20%. If you're going for forgiveness, especially if it's PSLF, the interest rate doesn't matter at all. And even if you're pursuing like pay 20-year forgiveness and you're uncertain if the tax bomb is going to happen or not, even then, the interest rate really doesn't matter that much because it grows at a rate of simple interest instead of compound, which is a big deal that most people don't understand. So if you think about the people benefiting from lower interest, will we see with limited future resources that the Congress is going to want to spend, will we see a lot of that get spent on borrowers, for high debt borrowers especially? And I don't think that will be the case. So if you change the interest rates, that's something that long-term Congress has to do. And if Congress does it, then it has to be subject to, you know, an analysis of how it affects the budget. And obviously, if you lowered interest rates on student loans, that's going to result in less income from the student loan system very transparently. And so that would increase the deficit. And do they want to do that or do they want to focus on cancellation? And I think that they're going to want to focus on cancellation, especially for low-income borrowers, borrowers in economic distress. So that's kind of why I think there's a lot of support in the Democratic side, especially to lower interest rates on student loans. But I think there's a lot of opposition on the Republican side to lowering interest rates on federal student loans. I think that from my understanding of this reconciliation process that the Democrats used to pass the latest stimulus bill that they got around the filibuster with, I think they can use that probably one more time. And I think they will probably use it one more time. And in the giant bill that they will do, probably some sort of infrastructure bill, will they put in student debt cancellation or will they lower interest rates or will they do both? My guess is that they would target it at student debt cancellation instead of student loan interest subsidies because it's just something that's probably a little more straightforward for them to do and not be attacked politically for supporting quote-unquote high-income, highly educated voters or something like that. The refinancing system in the private sense is always fascinating to me because it's kind of like the government's got loans that they're making to homeowners, right? Let's say flood insurance, and they charge the same price for flood insurance to people in the valley and on top of the mountain. They charge the same price to everybody, and everybody has to buy in. But then The people on the mountain are allowed to buy a private policy for flood insurance, and the people in the valley are allowed to, but they would never buy a private system for flood insurance because then they would be broke because they would have to pay so much, right? And so then the government loses the profit from the people at the top of the mountain that are paying way less for flood insurance by opting out of the federal system. That's kind of what student loan refinancing kind of does. So it is a really remarkable thing that exists, that it's allowed to exist. And I don't know how long it will exist long term in the sense of, you know, maybe people will be forced to pay back the loans at a certain interest rate. Probably not, because there's so many companies now that do it. It's probably here to stay, would be my guess. Now, let's talk about rates in general, because we talked a lot about student loan interest rates, right? So, I mean, this is kind of just a conversation about interest rates, just to help people understand like what they are, how to think about it, like what it is, just so that we can get more into like how it affects people's lives, right? So let's talk about interest rates in the big picture. I kind of talked about it in a narrow picture, just about how it affects your personal situation, right? But I want to talk about it in the big picture too. So the big picture is interest rates affect a lot of stuff in the economy and the prices of things in the economy. So there's this group called the Federal Reserve. You probably heard of them. They're a nonpartisan group that has existed since around like World War I that sets the interest rates in the economy, particularly for short-term rates. And it used to be the Federal Reserve kind of had somewhat of a narrow guidelines of what they would do. You know, you sort of would set the amount of capital banks had to hold on to, and you could set short-term interest rates, and that was mostly what they did. Their role changed really big in the 2008 financial crisis, because Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, was a student of the Great Depression. That's what his academic research was centered on. And he knew that in the Great Depression, the Federal Reserve did way too little to help prop up the economy. And we had a disastrous Great Depression in the United States. That depression spread worldwide. I don't necessarily think it's a coincidence that a lot of the more extreme elements of Europe were activated by the Great Depression, right? So there's huge consequences to bad economies sometimes. And so basically, the Federal Reserve in 2008 said, well, you know what? Let's like do other things to support the price of homes and stock market. And let's go out and buy bonds, long-term bonds, and that'll help hold down long-term interest rates. And that'll help support the stock market and support borrowing, support people buying homes, et cetera. So they did that. And they really mostly only did government-related bonds. But they did that, and it probably saved us from a Great Depression. Now, in 2020, with the corona crisis, they did the wildest stuff imaginable. In March and April, things were collapsing because people kind of thought that the Federal Reserve didn't have a lot left in the ammunition belt, so to speak, right? You're already buying all these bonds. You're already supporting the government bond market. But what needed support at the time was city and state governments, corporate bonds, like, you know, more risky kinds of debt that was not necessarily federal government related. And they did something that people have never dreamed that they would ever do before. They started buying corporate bonds and municipal bonds and supported the finances of all these different non-federal government related entities. They supported the prices of these entities. And that helped out a ton, because instead of, you know, cities having double-digit interest rates to borrow, right, like Chicago having to declare bankruptcy over this and having all kinds of mess from that, instead of that happening, they were able to continue borrowing at very low interest rates, and they were able to have stability. And a lot of these big corporations had stability. Carnival Cruise Lines was in the middle of doing a big deal with a hedge fund at like double-digit interest rates. And then the Federal Reserve intervened, and suddenly they were getting single-digit interest rates. And that helped keep the company together. So basically, in the 2020 corona crisis, the Fed brought out the bazooka and supported the economy in a way that they've never ever seen before. And then the federal government on the fiscal side brought out the fiscal bazooka and did like $6 trillion of stimulus. And that's like almost 10 times as much as they did in 2008. So it's just a whole nother world, right? And the Federal Reserve, of course, kept buying bonds. And when you buy a lot of bonds like that, it pushes down interest rates. So let's talk about interest rates. They've been low for a while. They've been going up. So what are some different theories out there in terms of the future, so you can know kind of what to think about, what to know, what to expect, and how it'll affect you? So there's this thing called modern monetary theory. It's a economical theory, economist's theory, that basically says you can have really high deficits and it's okay. It doesn't matter too much. So we'll see if that's true. People tended to think you needed to have debt smaller than the economy back in the day, and maybe we'll find out if that's true or not. Now, there's other people out there that are gold bugs or Bitcoin people, or people that have more extreme views that say, well, the currency is going to be worthless because the government's printing so much money, there's going to be hyperinflation. And then the most extreme iteration of this view is, you know, run for the hills, buy guns, stock up with your seed supply, et cetera, right? So there's varying levels of smart and crazy with all of these theories out there about what interest rates are at and what's going to happen. Interest rates could be a cause of mother of all bubbles. So I'm not saying it will be, but that's one thing that people are a little afraid about. And there actually is some legitimacy to having at least a fear about that or a worry about that. The good news is that probably matters more to somebody that has a ton of wealth built up already. And that means if you did have the mother of all bubbles and things collapsed in price, that'd be good for you. You could buy a lot more assets at a much cheaper price. But how do interest rates affect the values of things? I think that's something that's like really hard to understand if you're not a finance person. So I'm just going to kind of tell you in the simplest terms I can think of, like how interest rates influence the price of stuff like houses and stocks and practices and things like that. So if you have a low interest rate environment, let's say that you're borrowing, you know, 1% for the government and then lenders want an extra 1% of risk for a risk premium for the risk you don't pay them back because everybody loves risk, right? What you do is you come up with something called a discount rate, which is sort of like an interest rate, and you use it to calculate what a future amount of money is worth today. So we use this in our consults a lot, and we go into a lot more detail about what this means. It's called net present value if you want to look it up from the technical sense, but it's just a fancy way of determining what is a bunch of money in the future worth today. And this is really heavily influencing tech valuations, because let's say Amazon's going to make $100 billion in 50 years in profit. And let's say you use a 2% interest rate to value that today, that's $37 billion. Now, if you use a more normal interest rate of 4% government borrowing costs plus 2% credit premium, that's 6%. So if you discount $100 billion at 6% instead of 2, then that same amount of cash flow is only worth $5.4 billion today, which is 85% less. So if you want to know why have tech stocks had such a massive run-up, it's not just because these companies are amazing companies. That's true. It's primarily a story of low interest rates. Now, these, like I want to say too, these companies are extraordinary, but the value of these companies being so high has a lot to do with the overall level of risk in the economy being low, plus interest rates in general being low, causing these future potential profits to be just unbelievably exciting to investors. And companies that have a lot of money today that declines over time because they're dying companies, those are called value companies. Those have been way out of favor because interest rates have been so low for so long. Again, tech companies expected to have a lot of their profits in the future. For example, Tesla, right? Tesla's kind of valued based off of being the world's software for driving, plus having batteries that are going to power your home, plus being the biggest car manufacturer, all these things. And it very well could be all these things. But we know that profit is way off in the future. And in a low interest rate world, investors don't have other places to put money really and get some yield. So there's just way more, people are way more willing to take risks and lock money up for a long time for low interest rates and low prospects today. So that's one reason why, you know, things like student loan refinancing rates are so low is because, you know, the level of borrowing in the economy is really low because of all the stuff the Federal Reserve's doing. And then also credit risk is really low because nobody's worried about anybody paying them back because the economy's hot. What tends to happen is sometimes an economy can overheat. And how does it overheat? Well, you have more people demanding goods and services than the supply. And so then suppliers increase their prices to account for this massively larger demand. And then what ends up happening is the prices go up, and then basically the interest rates often will go up because people start getting worried about the level of prices. And suddenly you have an unstable economy, and people's wages can oftentimes, even though they're not declining, wages can actually fall pretty rapidly from inflation, from like employers that are not keeping up and keeping people's wages up with inflation, which is pretty common. So in a world with low interest rates, with people really willing to take risks, what happens is these low interest rates push stock prices to insanely high levels. Also, housing payments are way lower with lower interest rates, and so people can afford more house. And so what's the reason housing prices have soared? Partly it's living in inventory, but a big part of it is because mortgage payments, you know, are so low because interest rates are so low. And so people have just basically said, well, I can afford 20% more house. And so people have bid up the price of housing because their mortgage payment's been so much cheaper than they're used to because mortgage interest rates have been so low. And it's not just housing and stocks, it's everything. Anything that's really risky or speculative, people are buying the heck out of it. vacation homes, digital art, Michael Jordan rookie cards. The reason why these things are so high is probably because the stock market's so high. And the reason the stock market's so high is mainly because interest rates are so low. And the risk in the economy that people perceive is really low as well, where everybody is sort of excited about getting back to normal life. So that's the argument for the mother of all bubbles, and interest rates could be a major cause of it if it does end up being a bubble. So it's probably not crazily likely, though. We did a podcast a couple weeks ago about, is 2021 a bubble? And we sort of settled on, well, kind of. So rather than hyperinflation, I think what we might see is interest rates will probably just keep ticking up as the economy improves. And hopefully the Federal Reserve will be able to keep it in check so it's not really destabilizing. Right now, like student loan refinancing rates have been in the mid-3s for fixed for like 20 years for the highest qualified borrowers. That's insanely good. That's the lowest I've ever seen them for like long-term refinancing companies. That suggests that, you know, honestly, I feel like interest rates for refinancing will probably go up to the mid-4s or mid-5s for 20-year loans, probably sometime in 2021 or 2022. I don't know exactly when, but I would be a little surprised if interest rates are as low as they are today in a year from now. What does that mean for you? Well, first of all, I talked about how things are really highly valued because interest rates are so low. There's some things that you could do, like, you know, certain things are probably not going to crash too hard. It's probably just going to stay, the prices might just stay more stable longer, right? So I don't know, things like practice loans or houses, it's more about making a smart long-term decision for a practice. If you can find a practice that makes sense and you want to stay in an area for 5 years, if you're going to, you know, own your own business, I think it's okay to do that. I think it's a great time, one of the best times ever to do that. You might not be able to get capital as easily in the future if you have a bad economy. So now is a good time to look into that. Also, buying a house. I'd say now's a decent time to buy a house, even if you're paying 20% more than what people paid last year, if you follow the simple rule of limiting your house purchase to less than 2 times your joint income. If you can't find a house for less than 2 times your joint income, that's okay. You can go a little more than that. You can go 2.5 times. You could go 3 times. But just realize that if you go up to 3 times your income for a house purchase, you're going to be working probably until your 60s instead of having the flexibility to retire in your 40s or 50s if you really wanted to. So the house thing is the most impactful thing on when you can retire. It really is quite a big deal. Now, for refinancing, you know, why do we talk about something called the refinancing ladder strategy for student loan planner? We were the first person ever to talk about refinancing ladders and what it means and why. So refinancing ladder is like you're on a roof and you're walking down the ladder. I came up with this term because I used to blow the leaves off my dad's and mom's rental house. I don't know why they had like a 16-year-old dangling over the edge with a leaf blower, like on a roof. Like looking back on it, it's like probably like something that was like really dumb maybe. But I would always climb up and down on the roof on this ladder. And so that was the analogy that I thought of for explaining the strategy as me walking off of the top of the roof, holding my leaf blower for my mom and dad's rental house and starting on the top of the rung of the ladder and walking my way down until I was on the ground at safety. And so at the top of the ladder, that's your 20-year fixed rate. And then you, in the middle, it's like your 10-year. And then almost at the bottom is your 5-year. And then when you're on the ground, that's zero debt, right? And so we say for most people refinancing these days, we say, unless you're just amazingly rock solid with your finances, start off with a 20-year fixed. Start off with a 20-year fixed because you're going to lock in a very low historical rate that might end up being a great idea to just keep. Like if we have bad inflation and you've locked in a 3 or 4% interest rate for 20 years, that might be wonderful to leave that alone, right? And the thing is if you are experiencing like normal economic conditions, then what you do with the refi ladder is you refinance with a 20-year term, you get your bonus, your cash bonus at studentloanplanner.com/refi, and then you pay it down to some degree, like some significant amount, like you pay it down, maybe you have bonus payments, maybe you're throwing extra every month at the loan. There's no prepayment penalties for refinancing. You pay it down and then you refinance it again to maybe a 15-year or a 10-year loan. And the reason you do that is because when you start off with your refinance, they give you a monthly payment and then you can pay off a lot of the principal and refinance it to a shorter term. And oftentimes keep a similar payment that's not all that different from what you started off at, but you're also cutting down the length of time that you're in debt for, right? So if you take a case where you have $200,000 of loans, let's just say it's a $1,200 a month payment, and let's say you pay that down to $120,000, well, you could refinance to a 10-year and then keep your $1,200 a month payment approximately because they're setting it up for the 10-year amortization if you refinance it a second time. and then you keep paying it, and then eventually you could refinance it to a five-year fixed or a five-year variable to get the absolute lowest cost interest where almost everything is going to principal instead of interest. So that's the idea that one thing that you could do with interest rates, being afraid of interest rate risk like going up, is in general, like, rising interest rates are good for people that have a lot of debt because you're kind of rooting for it. You're like, yeah, heck yeah, I'd love to have some inflation if I have, you know, $500,000 of student loans, a $600,000 mortgage, and I have a $800,000 practice loans. Like, can anybody give me some inflation? Like, heck yeah. You know, but you could set yourself up even better if you have a 3 or 4% interest loan, and then you could simply say, well, I'm going to hold on to this because it's such a good deal because of inflation. And the thing is if you don't have bad inflation, you keep walking down the ladder. You take your 20-year loan, you refinance it to a 10-year, pay down some more, then you refinance it to a 5-year. So I think most people could benefit from refinancing federal loans at least three times, a 20-year fixed, a 10-year fixed, and a 5-year fixed or variable. And just getting a lower and lower required payment while giving yourself lots of flexibility with your cash flow by not overcommitting to a specific monthly payment, which I think is very important. And then, you know, obviously the other thing that you guys know is Student Loan Planner now is the only company that has bonuses of $1,000 or more with every major national lender. And that, you know, is conditional upon you having a certain amount to refinance with them. You don't get a $1,000 bonus for refinancing $5,000. I apologize. But if you have a six-figure amount that you're refinancing, a lot of times you can get those big bonuses. I've even heard of some crazy stuff happening in the refinance market where I don't necessarily want to say which lender because that might change by the time this podcast comes out. And then I don't want to say something that's inaccurate. But one of the companies has been rumored to offer like a deal in the month of April, I think it was, where they were going to suspend interest for 6 months or something like that to match the federal benefits. And then they were going to give a 3 or 4% fixed rate like after that too. I don't know what the terms are or the details are for that. And obviously everybody wouldn't qualify, but people are getting extremely aggressive with the refinancing market. So if you do need to pay your debt back, if you do know that you want to refinance federal loans, I think now would be a reasonable time to get started on your refinance ladder, or now would be a great time to take the next step down the refinance ladder to take your 20-year, your 15-year loan and refinance it again to a 10-year, for example, if you've been paying for a few years on your loan. If you're worried about, you know, inflation, you might even be able to lower your interest rate and extend your term if you think there's going to be inflation. There's all kinds of stuff that you can do and get those cash bonuses as well, and then mitigate the interest cost on your loans. For people going for forgiveness, right? I have to say this is not a strategy you should use. You could use it if you have any private student loan debt, but you know, people with going for forgiveness, you know, you can just focus on the interest rates and your other stuff. So you never want to overbuy a house just because interest rates are low. That's not a good idea. But again, if you're going to buy a house anyway, now's a great time to do it because we don't know what housing prices are going to do. We know interest rates are low right now, so don't overbuy. But now's a reasonable time to make these big life decisions like buying a house, buying a practice, all these things. And you know, if we do have, you know, a crash in the economy, that's why you protect yourself with having a good emergency fund, having payments that you've committed to that are not terribly high, and just giving yourself flexibility on cash flow so that if, you know, the market does crash 50% or 80%, heaven forbid, you'd have a lot of money left over to invest in that. So you really don't need to worry about rising interest rates nearly as much if you are a student loan borrower, which is good. The situation where you do need to be aware of it is, you know, it will mean worse refinancing deals. So it means you'd probably be more biased to refinance sooner, you know, than later if you're worried about rising interest rates. There could be higher housing payments. So if you're going to buy a house with a low interest rate, a low mortgage rate is going to give you a lower payment. So if you're going to buy one anyway, you might buy one a little sooner. Practice loans, same kind of thing. Higher interest means higher practice loan payments. So look into buying one sooner than you might think. The higher interest rates could mean lower stock market prices for reasons that we talked about in the show, which would be a good thing for people listening. Lower housing prices and practice loan prices could happen as well, but probably those would be more stable. So with interest rates probably primed to continue to increase, you want to lock in deals today with rates being pretty decent for whatever you're thinking about doing. If you're interested in trying to find out what company was offering the zero interest for 6 months, just go to studentloanplanner.com/refi if you know you need to refinance your loans, and then go ahead and apply at several of the different companies in the table there. And you know, you might see if you qualify for a benefit like that. remember too that you can ask questions on the voicemail, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. If you just type that into your browser and just you can leave a quick 30-second question on that device, and it's really kind of fun to answer your questions live on the show or recorded on the show. So please take advantage of that. And then a personal note, I'm actually going to be moving. Our whole family's moving for a job opportunity that my wife has. And so I'm going to be taking a few months away from doing consulting. Probably I'll come back sometime in early July doing consultations. And so this is sort of kind of like the earlier part of the year where I did a paternity leave and I was off a couple months for that doing the actual consultations. I'm not going to be just not working. I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes, doing the podcast, working on some different business projects and different business things we're trying to get over the finish line before interest rates and student loan payments begin yet again here in only a few months. And then we will need all hands on deck here when payments and interest start again in September. And so I want to make sure my schedule's wide open and clear for when we have this, probably this big surge of people trying to figure out what the heck is going on with my payments and am I in the right plan and did they give me credit during the interest freeze and all these different questions that I think we're going to run into. Just know that, you know, I know that I love doing consultations. I love talking to you all. Even though I only do about 10% of the plans now, probably even fewer than that, maybe even like 5% of the plans. I don't know. I don't do nearly as many as I used to just because, you know, I have to run the business and that's kind of become a pretty big responsibility because I want to give you the best content, best free content possible. And that takes a lot of work. So thank you for listening. Thank you so much for being a friend of the pod for the Student Loan Planner podcast and ask your questions if you have them. And thank you so much. Hopefully you learned a little bit today about interest rates and just how weird it is and how it all affects just absolutely everything. Thank you so much. Have a great week.